Since the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973, feminist anxieties about overturning Roe have been a persistent worry, but it become an acute fear under the court's current right-wing turn with the Trump appointees. Well, Mike, it seems perversely fitting that Texas, that state where Norma McCorvey, who became Jane Doe in this landmark case, was part of a lawsuit filed in U.S. federal court there against local DA Henry Wade, alleging that the Texas abortion laws were unconstitutional. Now, Texas is again the epicenter over abortion rights, with the Supreme Court adjudicating the fates of so many women. So let's start with this new law in the Lone Star State and the role of the Supreme Court. What's old and what's new in the law, the Texas law itself, that the Supreme Court authorized in what's called a shadow ruling on September 1st?
Well, the takeaway here, Jan, is that Roe v. Wade was born in Texas and it died in Texas. It is dead, is all but the official burial. The Texas law that's new bans all abortions essentially after 6 weeks of pregnancy.
And of course, it has been pointed out that most women don't even know they're pregnant until around 6-7 weeks.
Well, exactly. The first, Roe v. Wade had a clean breakdown of 3 different trimesters and said that during the first trimester, there's no question that the impregnated host, a woman, has complete autonomy and can do pretty much whatever she wants. And there's the second trimester allowed a little bit of government interference or oversight in some rare conditions. But basically, the question of viability in the third trimester was where the government was allowed to intervene.
Well, the idea being the fetus acquires some different status as it is able to live outside of the woman's body. Of course, viability was always a difficult issue because a fetus can survive, but with major handicaps that are difficult to care for. So there's always this question of what's meant by viability. But at any rate, it established some significant protections for women, but also for doctors who were being prosecuted in these cases before Roe v. Wade.
Well, yeah, viability is always an issue that's going to be litigated because the edge moves this way and that. It's close. But there was never any question about the first trimester until the new Texas law, which essentially got rid of more than half of that time, that 13-week period. So you would think that would be very easy. And when a law is passed, the Supreme Court should have upheld a preliminary injunction to keep it from being enforced until it can be examined. Now, there was a problematic and strange new element, namely the fact that the state tried to evade regulation by charging private citizens with the task of enforcing this law. They made anybody in the world capable of stopping any abortion and gave them lots of money to encourage them to do just that.
Anyone who may be assisting women in their access, attempts to access a service,
friends, family, drivers,
yeah.
I'm talking about people who are allowed to intervene, and that is everybody, everybody on the planet. You can be a serial intervener. You can sue 20, 30 people. You get $10,000 a pop. The legislation tried to enroll the entire country, the entire world, in its effort to evade enforcement against government officials. It's a phenomenally huge expansion of the idea of standing, which is a very traditional legal notion that you have to have some direct involvement in a case in order to go to court. Now, that one is complicated. So you've got something complicated and novel, this expansion of who can sue to stop an abortion. And you've got something that's really a clear square shot right at Roe v. Wade, something that just cuts more than half of the trimester in which a woman is allowed to be an autonomous person who can choose to keep the baby or to abort the fetus. What the Supreme Court should have done, and the obvious move, was to issue a stay because the whole question has not been briefed yet. But they didn't. They threw their hands up in the air and said, well, this is so complicated that we're not going to be able to take it on until it's fully briefed and litigated in lower courts. they focus solely on the complicated new standing question and overlooked entirely the fact that this law essentially ended Roe v. Wade.
So this was, in a sense, a kind of creative, clever move of the anti-abortion movement. And, you know, abortion has always been, when you talk about the heartbeat law, it's always been the heartbeat of the religious right. Conservatives have this fetishistic fixation on this issue and the fetus. And so it, in a sense, we might see this as an attempt to rally the troops in a larger right-wing movement where abortion has become so symbolic for them.
Well, it is clever. It is energetic. It's sharp. It's everything that abortion supporters have not been, because we've been able to rely on the sky gods and sky goddesses who did a really clever thing. And I use the word clever.
You mean the Supreme Court?
That's exactly who I'm talking
about. There's always been this dance around, even with Kavanaugh, you know, and Susan Collins quizzing him and coming before the news at a press conference saying she's convinced that this is standing law and these new Trump appointments are not going to unsettle established law. Well, apparently not.
Well, let's look at where that law came from. Roe v. Wade is based on a case called Griswold v. Connecticut, which is a 1965 case written by William Douglas, the greatest judge of the 20th century. Douglas found what he called a right of privacy in the Constitution. Now, the right of privacy is not specifically mentioned anywhere, but he said it was in the penumbra or shadows of other amendments, like the Fourth Amendment that protects you against unlawful search or seizures. The First Amendment, the freedom of expression, of religion. And he said that the idea of the state barging into a marital bedroom in order to enforce laws that would have banned people from buying contraceptives, which was the law at stake, is anathema to the U.S. and to our Constitution and to the new right of privacy. So the right of privacy was first articulated in Griswold, and then it was the basis of a later case to supporting the right to birth control for unmarried couples from 1972, the Roe v. Wade in 1973, the right to contraception for juveniles in 1977, the right to homosexual relations in 2003, the right to same-sex marriage in 2015. They're all based on one form or another of the right to privacy. But that right is not clearly articulated in the Constitution, and it could be seen, and probably should be seen, as a political notion.
Just to talk about that legal and rhetorical strategy, it's been a two-edged sword in the history of social movements. Throughout much of the late 20th century, liberals made the point, well, homosexuality was okay, and the privacy, it was like don't ask, don't tell during the Clinton administration, the military, what gay people do in the privacy of their own bedrooms is fine, just don't put it in my face. Women have had abortions, terminated pregnancies, probably as long as women have been getting pregnant, and doctors have assisted them. It wasn't until there was a mass mobilization of women on the streets that this became such a signature issue of women's emancipation. So was there, something problematic from the start about using right of privacy as a broad political legal argument, given that a lot of movements face their opposition when they become public out in the streets and fight for something bigger than what they would do in their own private homes or in their own private conversations with their doctors?
I think the right to privacy is very real and is worth protecting and relying on, and it has been relied on for many important decisions. The problem is relying on the court. The problem is thinking that these sky gods and goddesses are not ever going to just fold their tents and walk away, or actually that they will all die off. They are all dead now. We're not dead. We're alive. And we're dealing with a political situation where we've been totally outflanked. The quote, right to life movement has been active in every possible way, from just the grossest murders to the most genteel tea sessions and church visits. They've been active at small levels, in small towns, at the state level, at the federal level. They've been creative, they've been energetic, and they now have a court that supports them.
Although most Americans, according to public polls, support the right of abortion, certainly for the first trimester, sizable majorities, including Catholics, oppose overturning Roe v. Wade. And, exactly. It's kind of interesting. The Supreme Court, these are not like the Republican politicians who are running scared about the wind at their back with the next election coming up. These are lifetime appointees who ideally are protected from the hurricanes generated by the religious right.
It's true. It's one of those issues where most people support the notion of abortion, but it's not a front and center issue. Whereas those who oppose it, many of them are absolutely dedicated. It's what they do in life. So that always creates a skewed situation. They have been targeting the bench, and they've done so very successfully. They now have people who do not believe in Roe v. Wade, who have already essentially eliminated it, and will the idea of having some formal ceremony in the future is going to be just symbolic, because Roe v. Wade right now is dead.
So given that, we should grieve and mourn appropriately, but then turn out perhaps learning from that history in larger numbers. And how do you see the role of legal strategies in the fight for reproductive justice, which in many ways is stronger by some measures than the pro-choice movement of the 70s and 80s that didn't include things like access to health care, access to child care, not only the right to end a pregnancy, but the right to care for the children we bring into the world. The emphasis on reproductive justice and Black feminist insights to how people of color are particularly affected by access to health care, and through the history of including the oppression within the existing medical system, healthcare system, so that in many ways the movement has broadened and deepened its politics, but there is still this question of how do we mobilize and organize in turning from just pleading our case before the chief justices and turning to the streets or other avenues for fighting back.
Well, you've asked two questions. One is, what are legal remedies? And then you've shown all the ways in which there is now much greater public support, which is true. And legal strategies always follow the public. I mean, legal decisions are, rarely do they ever lead. They're compelled. But there are legal strategies, aside from all the necessary mobilization you're talking about. I think the best one is sort of a jujitsu use of the First Amendment and religious liberty. You may have noticed that religious liberty is the hot item among the present court members. The Supreme Court ruled in a 7-2 decision that actions by a Colorado Civil Rights Commission violated the free exercise clause of the and religious liberty of Jack Phillips, who's a Christian baker who refused to create a cake for a same-sex wedding. They had a 7-2 majority, and Gorsuch wrote a separate concurring opinion, articulating an even stronger defense of religious liberty, pointing out how many hospitals now are allowed to and do in fact make decisions about what to do and what not to do on a religious basis. And Justice Thomas wrote a separate concurring opinion defending Jack Phillips' free speech claims under the First Amendment. Well, abortion rights is a First Amendment issue, given that many religions, including Reformed Judaism, fully endorse them, and the ideology opposing such rights is religious-based. Therefore, when you ban legal abortions, the state is endorsing one religion over another, which is unconstitutional. Abortion rights are about women's rights to the same freedoms as men, including the right to enjoy sex. They're about women's freedoms as human beings, as autonomous creatures, as opposed to slaves from a state or a patriarchal control. Calling for the right of abortion is, in the most profound sense, a call for sexual freedom and equality. We need to get away from the fear that constricts us to just defining abortions as health care and take it on squarely as part of a broad worldview we could call a religion, and certainly would be defined as a religion under the currently operating notion of religious liberty.
So, okay. Well, with that rousing call to the courts and the streets, we'll stop for today, but continue to follow this, because we are going to have to organize to fight back. And I think there's more on our side in many ways, and creative energy around what's called intersectional politics, how the issue of abortion intersects with so many other aspects of people's lives. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Supreme Court and the new Texas law.